Case number 10-5014, Wilfred Samuel Radigan versus Eric H. Holder, Jr., Attorney General, United States Department of Justice Appellant. Mr. Scarborough for appellant, Mr. Moore for appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court, Charles Scarborough for the FBI. I'd like to try to preserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Under Egan and this court's decisions in Bennett and Ryan, it is clear that Title VII claims predicated upon the denial or the revocation of a security clearance are non-justiciable. If the FBI had actually revoked plaintiff's security clearance in this case, there can be no doubt that neither the referral nor the investigation leading to the revocation would be reviewable under Egan. Nevertheless, the district court held that because the FBI acted more responsibly and did not revoke plaintiff's clearance after investigating the security concerns identified, Egan does not preclude his claims. That decision is both unprecedented and wrong. Egan precludes a fact finder from second-guessing the predictive judgment of executive branch officials regarding security risks, including the judgments about whether an investigation is warranted.
Under the government's view, is there any basis at all for distinguishing between the referral and the actual decision by the security division as to whether to pursue an investigation?
No, Your Honor. I mean, our argument proceeds upon two tracks. One, that it really does implicate the judgment of the security division people as well, and we don't want to in any way distract from that argument. But in our view, Executive Order 12968 really does charge all agency officials within the FBI, all the people that hold.
Yeah, I understand that. So, but under your theory then, this essentially eviscerates the retaliation protections of Title VII in any situation where, say, a supervisor decides to retaliate against an employee who charges racial discrimination or something simply by referring, by making charges to the security division, right?
Well, I don't agree that, it eviscerates it, Your Honor. And again, the court was confronted.
No, but doesn't it? Can you give me an example of a situation where a supervisor who has been charged with discrimination refers that employee to the National Security Division?
Well, again, it depends upon the nature. Egan instructs, in this court's decision in Bennett and Ryan, instruct that it depends upon the nature of the decision.
Okay, well, give me an example of a case where that would be actionable.
Well, again, it's hard to talk in the abstract here. I mean, again, this court was confronted with the exact same argument in Bennett, that you, once you raise the national security flag, that you're immunized.
I'm trying to find out from you whether I understand your point about I understand your point that the concern in this case is that because of the jury instruction and the testimony that the decision of the National Security Division to launch an investigation, that is Schubert, was that his name, Schubert? That
Schubert was one of the deciders,
yeah,
yes.
That his judgment was at issue, and that's out of bounds. Okay, I got that.
Right.
What I'm asking you is whether there are any limits to this. For example, suppose we knew in this case, without a doubt, that Layton's charges were not only false, but he knew they were false. Okay, that he had lied.
Again, I mean,
and we know that.
Well,
would that be actionable by the plaintiff here?
Again, if Egan gives a shield to decisions, predictive judgment by the executive branch.
No, don't respond with quotes from Egan. Okay.
Okay.
I'm asking you a hypothetical about. I'm asking about this case.
I understand, Your Honor.
You said when I asked you earlier that there may be a basis for distinguishing between the referral and the actual decision of the security division, and And I thought I tried to help you out with the hypothetical by saying that I understand your point that in this case.
Yes.
Okay? In this case, because of the jury instruction and the testimony that there may well have been improper inquiry into the legitimacy of the National Security Division's decision as to whether to launch the investigation. So, you know, you can answer my hypothetical without jeopardizing this case. That's okay.
I understand, Your Honor.
So, what is the limit? Suppose, for example, number one, the charges were absolutely false. Okay, and there was no doubt about the legitimacy of the National Security Division's decision to launch an investigation. In other words, that's just not on the table. This guy made false claims in order to retaliate. Now, why wouldn't that be actionable? Well, if the jury's instructed that they have to limit their inquiry into the motivations of Layton.
Well, I guess one response is that just the referral, and the district court recognized this in the course of the proceedings below, just the referral, if it had gone nowhere, wouldn't be materially adverse action. You have to then have something.
Why wouldn't it?
Well, because you have to have something that actually injures you.
But this is a retaliation case, and the Supreme Court and we have both said the standards are different here. And, I mean, we've said that, for example, an adverse evaluation, at least for retaliation purposes, is a material adverse action. Besides, it's a jury question. And it seems to me not even plausible to suggest that a rational jury couldn't conclude that that making false accusations to the National Security Division could be a material adverse action, that it could discourage people from filing complaints.
Again, Your Honor, I think what your question goes to is trying to distinguish.
Do you disagree with that?
What
I just said?
You said a lot.
No, I only said one thing.
Can you repeat it, please? I'm sorry. I'm not trying.
I said that it seems to me that a rational jury, reasonable jury, could conclude that a referral of this type to the National Security Division would dissuade someone from filing a charge of
discrimination. Well, again, that wasn't the district court's view. The district court believed that
it was. I know that. I know that.
I understand.
I'm trying to get you to help me understand whether there's anything left of the rehabilitation part of Title VII under your theory of the case. That's all I'm trying to ask.
Okay, Your Honor. And let me respond. I will try to respond to the hypothetical, but I will say that the court, of course, doesn't, as you pointed out, the court does not have to reach the larger issue here because we have clearly.
That's why I called it a hypothetical.
I understand that. Security division
don't,
judgment
don't,
implicated.
Don't,
all right, well, I will try to respond to the hypothetical.
Have a limited amount of time.
But I guess my response is still the executive order commits the lower level officials, people who don't have security division in their title.
Okay, so your answer then is yes. No matter what the circumstances of the case, if the referral is to the National Security Division, it's immunized from a Rehabilitation Act claim under Title VII.
If it raises security concerns,
that's
yes,
like
Your Honor, and this unquestionably did.
So does an employee like the person here, does he have any other remedy for what happened?
For what happened? Well, yeah. What happened was ultimately the investigation decided he wasn't a security risk. So what happened was actually relatively minimal.
His reputation was smeared.
Well, I understand, Your Honor, but this is a situation in which the FBI is an agency that has to take security concerns very seriously. So,
counsel, what we're trying to focus on is that this court and other courts have not taken this blanket position you're suggesting, and we're trying to understand the limits of the government's argument. And if you don't want to help us in that, that's all right, but don't be surprised when you get an opinion.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's important to distinguish what the court needs to decide, and the government is not going to concede away the notion.
That's why we're calling these hypotheticals.
I understand
that. You don't have to lecture us about the difference between what we need to decide in this case and what we don't. We're trying to understand the limits of this argument, let me just tweak my hypothetical once more. Okay, suppose in this case we knew Layton's allegations were false, and that he knew they were false, and that the plaintiff stipulates that the launching of the National Security Division's investigation was completely justified. So that's off the table. Nobody has to question Schubert. The jury doesn't have to be instructed about that. The only question now is, did Mr. Layton make a false accusation against the plaintiff in retaliation for him filing an employment case?
And the question, I mean, again, I think that goes to the jury or the fact finder would still be required to decide whether these were legitimate security concerns or not.
So anytime the government interposes a defense of national security, the court loses jurisdiction.
Again, I think the decisions in Bennett and Ryan go pretty.
No.
If they are.
I can explain, but let's.
I think this court went pretty far down the line, along that way in Bennett. If there's a contemporaneous security-based reason.
I read your brief, and I stopped when I read that sentence, and went back to reread Bennett. All right, we didn't say what your brief says we said in Bennett. All right.
What?
So let's just move on. We didn't say that amicus's concerns are ridiculous and have no merit.
I don't think we tried to say that
well,
they have no merit.
Well, you did say. You said the court rejected amicus's concerns. We rejected it in a very specific context where the whole case was turning on the denial of a security clearance. And we have other cases in this court where the court has rejected as broad a position as you're taking today. And I assume you're familiar with those cases, and so we're just trying to understand, as Judge Tatel has been urging you to tell us, whether there are any limits.
Again, it's hard to concede away a future case in which someone raises, someone charged under the executive order with reporting information about security concerns to the appropriate division with the FBI. And to say that, you know, a jury should be able to second guess whether those concerns were in fact true or were in fact a pretext for retaliation. I'm not willing to do that here.
Is there a procedure? Are there circumstances? Could the National Security Division found that Layton's charges were uncorroborated and unfounded? Would the government, are there procedures for the government disciplining someone for making charges like that?
Yes, Your Honor. All manner of procedures.
Did that happen here?
Again, I'm not aware of any specific discipline, any sanctions that were imposed upon Layton. But let me explain that the security allegations were deemed, and this is the testimony of Mark Bullock, the Security Division official, one of the people who looked into this. I'm quoting from Appendix 317. He said the allegations from a security perspective were deemed unfounded.
Yeah.
Many of the things, the basic facts that Layton reported were uncontestedly true. The situation with plaintiff going on the Hajj and leaving directions that he could be contacted only through the Saudi intelligence people, the wearing of the Saudi garb. The question was, well, what security inferences are you supposed to draw from those?
I was just asking you what are the procedures the government would use to discipline someone who made false claims?
Well, again, I think it could be a full, depending upon the nature of the allegations and whether they were in fact knowingly false, it could be a referral to OPR, uh-huh. Could be an IG investigation. If they're really knowingly false, it could be criminal prosecution.
You mean within justice, I see.
Well, no, I think there could be a criminal prosecution. If there's a knowingly false statement made, I mean, that applies to, that's a criminal provision.
Yeah.
So I think there are substantial internal constraints uh-huh. against the hypothetical that you're positing, just the willy-nilly reporting of allegations that are completely unfounded. That's not this case.
In this case, did the EC say that, was it signed under oath?
I don't believe it was signed under oath, Your Honor. The EC was, and again, the EC was referred to the Security Division for appropriate investigation as they saw fit. The EC on the cover page also noted that plaintiff had engaged in protected activity. All the information was passed on to the Security Division, in other words.
Do you know whether in FBI training around the executive order that employees who are encouraged to bring this information to the attention of the National Security Division are also warned that that they have to be sure their information is, that they can't use false information, that it can't be used for other purposes. Do you know whether that's...
I do not know for a fact whether that is the case. I would assume that is the case, and I would assume that's something that's implicit in the trust that you're given as an FBI employee. These are very serious allegations. One does not make them lightly. And the point is that once one sees problems, sees things that raise security hackles, for them. It goes to a different branch. They investigate that. They figure out what is going on here. That's appropriately what the employer should do. In fact, that's the type of independent investigation that under the cat's paw theory would normally preclude liability. The employer did the appropriate investigation here like they were supposed to.
Can I make sure I understand exactly where your position is, which is it that a referral for an investigation, the initiation of an investigation, and the revocation of a security clearance, any of those three cannot be the subject of a discrimination claim?
Yes, Your Honor. The preliminary steps leading up, and we think that, again, the court's decisions in Bennett and Ryan go some way towards that. Right. The preliminary steps, they involve the same predictive judgment being exercised about security risk, evaluating whether a security risk is sufficiently serious to warrant referral is the same type of predictive judgment that ultimately, the security division is called to make as to whether it is, sufficiently serious to warrant revocation. That's our point. It's the nature of the judgment that Egan protects. And to the extent that type of judgment is being called into play, yes, Egan is a shield there. Now, again, I want to emphasize, preach to the court, but that the court doesn't need to go so far here because here we clearly have the people charged with investigating and revoking and denying security clearances. Their judgment was clearly implicated in this case.
Could Congress, if your position were adopted here, could Congress change it?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Maybe I spoke too soon because, again,
you recognize that Egan is not a constitutional rule. It's a background canon of statutory construction.
Egan is grounded in separation of powers concern. So I want to take back the quick concession because I really haven't had time to think about that. I think that Congress could certainly modify.
I think your quick concession was correct, but okay. You can take it back nonetheless.
Well, let me waffle, if you will. I think that the primary point here is that Egan deference does not depend upon ultimately the outcome of the investigation. That's where the district court sort of went wrong here.
What I'm concerned about is, for example, in one of our opinions, we didn't accept at face value the government's interpretation that something, because of Egan, the court couldn't make any judgments. And in the drug testing case, we said, we do not believe, however, that the government's interest in preserving all its secrets can justify the testing of all federal prosecutors or all employees with access to grand jury proceedings. Now, your argument suggests that the court had no business, quote, second-guessing the government's position that we need to drug test all of these people because of concerns about national security.
No, Your Honor.
And the executive order says that everybody's supposed to report on everybody and nobody can ever be held accountable for anything because they're not going to swear under oath when these documents are submitted.
Respectfully, Your Honor, yeah. I believe you're quoting from Harmon. Am I correct?
Yeah.
I believe that case involved, number one, constitutional claims, and number two, challenges to policies. And
Did you hear what I read?
I did, Your Honor.
All right. In that statement, this court is saying it disagrees with the government's judgment about what is necessary to protect secrets.
Again,
right?
Yes, Your Honor. And what I was trying to...
Under your argument, as I understand it in response to Judge Tatel's questions, that would have been an improper consideration for the court.
No, Your Honor, and I'm apologizing if my argument appears that broad. We have no quarrel, obviously, with the decisions in this court saying that there is some room for the court to look at policies in particular that the executive branch has adopted in conjunction.
If a court is competent to make these types of judgments, all right, then why not in a Title VII context as well?
Well, Your Honor, I think the answer it lies in Ryan and Bennett, and it's because
Ryan said that administrative board did not have authority to second guess the security determination. And that was the security determination made by the entity that was given responsibility for making that.
I'm actually not sure that it's at all clear from that case. I mean, what was at issue in Ryan was the refusal to do the waiver.
That is the way the case has been interpreted, all right? And in implying it, at least in this circuit, we have been very clear in Ryan, in the KRC case, in Bennett, that where there was an action taken based on a revocation of a security clearance, the plaintiff couldn't proceed. Because
again,
everything turned on the revocation of the security clearance.
But again, now, Your Honor, may I respond?
Could I respond first?
Yes.
Those are distinctions that courts have drawn in cases. And the Third Circuit more recently has drawn a distinction. We've drawn other distinctions. The other case you're probably familiar with is the case of the author who worked for the CIA, and we sent it back to the district court for the district court to examine whether or not this type of material was such that it should come within the strictures. I mean, you're just saying the courts have no role when security is involved, and we're trying to understand what are the limits of your argument. And I gather from your answer to Judge Tatel, even if somebody knowingly, blatantly submits false information and causes a referral, retaliation is on racial, sexual, gender grounds is no longer something the courts can consider.
Your Honor, there's a lot there. The point I was going to make about Bennett is that that case didn't actually involve a revocation of a security clearance there.
She needed to get this clearance, and she couldn't get it. And then she tried to get another job, and they said, you know, she resigned, and here's the terms of the settlement agreement. It all turned on whether she could get the security clearance. This is not that case. That's all I'm trying to say.
I understand. And what we're trying to say in response is that the court recognized in Bennett and in Ryan that you wouldn't look behind whether the security concerns are legitimate or not. And that's precisely what...
Am I correct in understanding your answer to Judge Tatel's question?
That we do believe that the people charged under the executive order, the people in this case, the OIO officials, who, when they identify security concerns that they believe warrant referral, are entitled to deference under EGAN. Yes. So you're correct in that respect, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Thank
you. We'll hear from counsel for appellee.
May it please the court, Jonathan Moore for the appellee, Mr. Rattigan. On the eve of this trial, the government raised a justiciability argument after 5 years of litigation. The court, literally on the eve of the last business day before the trial was to commence, the court, the district court, Judge Havel, issued a written decision, which we believe is unassailable here. And it's all based on EGAN. She looked at EGAN and she said, she thought EGAN as it properly is a narrow decision. EGAN was considered the very narrow question of whether a challenge to the substance of a decision to deny or revoke a security clearance is justiciable. And there's obviously good reasons for that, because the executive has placed in the hands of certain executive officials the decision with respect to a national security decision with respect to somebody as a security risk. That is not this case. There was neither an examination of the substance, nor was there a denial or revocation of the security clearance.
Would you agree? Suppose the retaliation claim here was against Schubert.
Well,
would you agree then that this would be barred by by EGAN?
I think that for the most part, we would probably have to concede that if the decisions were being made, if there was any substantive decision that...
But even if this were a case against Schubert and the result, that everything else was the same, namely that the security clearance was not revoked, that this would still be protected, this would still be covered by EGAN, right?
I'd have to know the circumstance of that, but Judge...
No, the circumstances of this case.
under the circumstances of this case.
But Schubert is a defendant.
Yeah, he's a defendant.
That's the only change.
Well, the Security Division was never a part of this case.
No, no, but I'm asking you, neither one of you like hypotheticals this morning, do you? We should have a little flag we put up that says, hypothetical, no? You can't answer a hypothetical by saying it's not this case.
Well, that's fine, Judge.
Okay.
Schubert had, for some improper motive, because...
No, forget the improper motive. Just exact facts of this case, okay? Cases against Schubert.
Well, Schubert would have to have had some basis to make that determination, to make a referral.
No, the referral came from Leighton. Same referral. It's just that Schubert's also a defendant.
Well, if Schubert was a defendant, I think it would be a more difficult case.
Okay,
I think it would be harder. We're encroaching on that line.
Yes.
I mean, I think that the cases of Egan and its progeny have been very careful to set out a demarcation.
Well, we haven't had a case like this before.
Well,
no one's had.
There's a reason
no
for
one's
that.
Had an, had
there's a reason for that because.
Yeah.
Because it's unique that would arise in this circumstance.
Let me not. Let's not play with hypotheticals. Let me tell you what my concern is about your theory, and you tell me why it's wrong. Okay.
Yes.
The way I see this, with the jury instruction and the testimony by Schubert, I mean, it looks to me like, in making its judgment here, the jury had to assess the National Security Division's judgment to launch an investigation.
No, I think that's absolutely incorrect, Judge.
Okay.
I don't think there was, the court was very clear. Counsel in their argument, I represented the plaintiff below. We were very careful when we talked to the jury about what this case was about. It had nothing to do with the Security Division. It had everything to do with officials who are not the kind of officials whose predictive authority this line of cases are designed to protect, making a referral for retaliatory reasons. The evidence was clear that
The district judge believed that the material adverse action here, right, was the initiation by the Security Division of its investigation. In fact, that's what the jury found, correct?
Well, the jury was asked.
Well, I'm just reading the jury instruction. It says
whether
whether
the initiation of the investigation was an adverse action.
It says the initiation of the investigation by the Security Division was the material adverse action, not the referral.
Yeah, but the initiation has a predicate, which is that the referral from the OIO, and the case was about whether that referral, which led to a security investigation, or whether that referral was retaliatory. It did not require the jury to consider anything about...
But the district judge didn't think that that was a material adverse action, right?
Well, standing alone, if it was just a referral and the Security Division did nothing with it, that alone may not be an adverse action, although you could argue that it would be.
Under the law, doesn't the court have to examine the material adverse action that's at issue? That's the question. That's what has to be retaliatory.
Right.
Okay, so the district court instructed the jury, and the district jury found that the material adverse action was the launching of the investigation by the National Security Division, and that's why Schubert testified what he did. He was asked, what he thought, what circumstances here justified an investigation, and he testified as to that. And even when the district court allowed the polygraph testimony evidence in, the district court did it because she said, we need to know what Schubert was thinking and why he acted.
I don't think it's so clear that that's what Schubert did. I think what Schubert
did,
what Bullock did, and there was, this was the testimony at trial, was that they get this referral, not just from Leighton, but by the section chief of the Office of International Operations, saying, this person is a security risk. He's disloyal. He's too close to the Saudis. He's gone native, as the term was used. They had no choice. They didn't do any kind of preliminary investigation. They simply handed it off to an investigator. That's what they testified to at trial. There was no prima facie determination.
That's not what Schubert testified to.
Schubert's
very clear. He says, the question is, what what in Layton's report raised concerns for you? Answer, not any single issue, but as a whole. Certainly it raised an issue of foreign influence. And then he goes on to say, specify. He says the gift of clothing, the fact that they were helping him look for a wife, that he prohibited these temporary duty people from working. So in other words, Schubert went through the facts and said why he launched the, what it was that concerned him.
Judge, I don't think that's accurate. If you look at the entire record,
reading to you from the transcript.
I'm sorry, Judge.
I was reading to you from the transcript.
Judge, that Schubert testified and Bullock testified that they did no review of the substance, and that's what the court has been concerned about.
They made a judgment that the allegations were of the type that were sufficient to deserve an investigation.
But that wasn't at issue in the case. That was not argued in the case. It was the focus of the argument, the focus of the evidence was about what was in the mind of Mike Pizmuka, of Donovan Layton, the officials in OIO. That's what was being considered.
I understand that's what you said in your your opening statement to the jury. All right? And what I'm concerned about is some of the instructions that the jury heard and the verdict form. And what I was looking for was something where the judge told the jury, you do not have, or the plaintiff, or, you know, jurors, you are not to consider whether or not the security division investigation was proper or was
right.
Improperly motivated. That is not on the table in this case.
Well, it certainly was on the table because that's what we argued to the jury. The jury clearly understood from the beginning and during the case and at the end that this was not about the security division, was about OIO. Even the defendants in there.
Here's what I'm getting at that is of concern to me. I think I understand your point mm-hmm. about how the case was tried.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, I haven't read all of the transcript, but right. I've read a lot of it in terms of the evidence that was there. But the verdict form says, has the plaintiff, the name, proven by preponderance that the initiation of the investigation by the security division was a materially adverse action? That's
right.
One thing they had to find.
All
right. Go ahead.
That has to be understood in the context of what the evidence was in the case. That perhaps there should have been the initiation of the investigation by the defendants of a security division investigation. In other words, which is what it says in the second question.
No, I understand your point. What I'm getting at is, what's of concern to me in this case was, did the jury clearly understand the limits of what this case was about?
I think
distinct from when you read some of the language here in the instructions, it doesn't say as clearly as you said in your opening argument.
And in the closing as well.
And
it's also what the defendants said to the court, to the jury. The defendants three times in their closing said, the issue is whether the security investigation was initiated because Rattigan was complaining he had been discriminated against. They're not talking about the security division. They understood. I have to say, I think the whole issue of the security division and them making a so-called independent investigation when they actually did not, that whole issue was a last-minute trial tactic to avoid what was a fairly strong case of retaliation, and I think the judge clearly saw through that.
Can I ask you about referrals, initiation of investigations, and revocation of clearances? It seems to me all three of those things are basically the same question. Mm-hmm. Is the person a risk? And there are different standards of proof probably not the right word, but different standards one applies in deciding whether to refer, whether to initiate, and whether to revoke. A much lower standard for the
right.
The first, a little bit higher for the initiation, a little bit higher still, or probably a lot higher still for revocation. But it isn't the same issue?
I don't think it is, Judge. I mean, it's certainly on the spectrum, mm-hmm. but I think what we have to keep in mind here is that if the if a plaintiff is challenging simply the referral or the initiation, and it's not challenging either procedural or the substantive activities of the Security Division, that situation clearly does not lead to a finding of non-justiciability. The Egan and the case and its progeny are very clear that they're looking at, that they want to shield an analysis that goes to the substance of the decision to deny or revoke. The substance of that decision was done in the investigation by Ms. Tucker.
This lack of review, the substance of the decision to refer.
Well, this decision to refer was made by OEO, and I don't think those
or the,
are...
Or the substance of the decision to initiate. And well, my question went to, isn't it really the same kind of question as the substance of the decision to revoke, just with a different standard?
No, I don't think it is. First of all, on the facts of this case, there was no substantive determination by either Bullock or Schubert that these allegations merited an investigation. They simply did the ministerial task of finding an investigator. I mean, after all, they get an allegation from section chief of the Office of International Operations saying, this guy's a security risk. So obviously they're going to send it off for investigation. But they themselves did no determination as to the merits
of
it.
When was this, by the way?
What year?
Mm-hmm.
That was in 2002 was when the security investigation was conducted.
Mm-hmm.
He says, excuse me, but Schubert says we don't launch an investigation every time one comes to us. We consider the FBI guidelines to determine whether to launch an investigation.
I'm sorry, Judge, I didn't understand the question.
Oh, I was responding to your point that they just automatically sent this off for an investigation.
There was no, in fact, there was no predictive judgment as the case.
No, you're totally right about that.
Yeah.
You're completely right about that. But they did, Schubert's testimony suggests that he did look at this and made a conclusion based on the FBI guidelines that these charges warranted an investigation.
I mean, they're giving it more substance than they really did. They did no independent investigation.
You're totally right about that, too. You're totally right. But I think Judge Kavanaugh is just asking the same question different ways, which is that by Schubert saying, for example, let's just take a specific, that the charge that he received clothing from the Saudi security police, that he received clothing from, that was worthy of an investigation, that's essentially a judgment that under certain circumstances, that might be a basis for revoking a security clearance.
I don't think Schubert or Bullock looked at the substance of the specific allegations. They had an 18-page EC, which at the end said, he's a security risk.
Well, you and I mean, I'm just looking at the testimony here. You know, you tried the case, and I wasn't there, but I'm reading the transcript, and that's not what Schubert says.
Schubert says, to be fair, he did try to say that, but he also admitted that he didn't do any investigation.
I totally agree with you. He did not do an investigation. He sent it to someone else to investigate, but he made a judgment. And this is what's bothering me about the case, and maybe you have a good answer to it, but he made a judgment that these are the kinds of charges, receiving the clothing from the Saudi security police, then looking for a wife, going on a Hajj, those are the kinds of things that could justify the revocation of security.
I understand that's the
and
sort
that's,
of difficult.
That's what Egan says he can't second guess.
I'm sorry, Judge?
That's what Egan says.
No, I don't think so. I think Egan says that you're looking at substance.
How about Ryan?
Well, Ryan as well, even though Ryan is a little bit different.
But this is the substance
procedurally,
because it isn't. It's in a sense, it's as if it's no different from the ultimate judgment to revoke a security clearance based on receiving gifts from a foreign security officer. Isn't any different? At least I can't see the difference.
Well, first
between,
of all,
let me just finish my sentence.
I'm sorry.
I can't see the difference between that judgment and the judgment of an earlier official saying, I believe these charges, if true, could justify the revocation of a security clearance.
Well, that's where I'm stuck. Yeah, I understand. I think Ryan is the closest that the government can get to these facts, but even with Ryan, because you have a there was a procedural hurdle that could not be met there with the fact that they couldn't do this background investigation because these people were out of the country, and that the court said, as Judge Rogers said in that case, that you can't examine that decision without examining the underlying merits of the plaintiff's clearance denial.
So
here there was no denial. There's no revocation.
So your argument then, and I want to be sure I understand, is that the reason why we don't have a Ryan or Egan problem here is because Schubert didn't do any independent investigation. He just referred it on, and therefore, is that how we distinguish this case from?
Well, that's one of the basis, Judge. The other basis is that the officials who the government seeks to shield with the immunity are not the kind of officials whose predictive judgment that the cases want to protect.
What about the executive order, which requires?
Well, the executive order says
to make
a determination of eligibility for access to confidential information is a discretionary security decision based on judgments by appropriately trained adjudicated personnel.
Right, but I was asking about the part of the executive order that says all people with security clearances are encouraged to report.
Well, that's fine. Everybody's encouraged to report wrongdoing or it's like if you're a park ranger supervisor and your underling.
We don't have national security concerns with park rangers.
Well, I don't know. He's a federal employee. And let's say the supervisor is reporting his park ranger because he's reading Al-Qaeda literature.
Okay, so that we got two bases. Right, so one argument is that Schubert didn't make an independent investigation. Number two is that that Layton and that crowd who work for OIO, they're not in the National Security Division, right?
Well, they're not the kind of officials who are given the responsibility to make that predictive judgment. Schubert said that at the trial. That's what Egan says, and that's what the executive board says.
You heard from my questions to government counsel that I'm looking for a way to try to cabin this, okay?
Right.
So maybe you can help me. So let's assume you're right, that the OIO people are kind of different, right? So they're charged. There's a Rehabilitation Act. This case, Layton's answer to any charge of retaliation is, well, Schubert thought it was worth investigating. That's why it's not pretext.
Well,
and so we're right back where we were.
No, because we're not challenging. As Judge Chevelle correctly understood, there's no challenge here to the substance of any security division. In fact, we embrace that because he was exonerated by that.
I guess, See, when the jury is instructed, it says influenced by non-decision makers, and it says, you know, the plaintiff does not need to prove that the security division personnel who authorized the investigation were motivated by a retaliatory motive. If the plaintiff proves by preponderance of evidence that these personnel were influenced by the referral and that the stated reason OIO personnel provided for the referral was not the true reason.
Well,
it's that influence part.
Yeah.
Why was that a part of the case?
Well, because I think Judge Chevelle.
In other words, just in my hypothetical is, suppose OIO sends this over and Schubert just throws it on the ground and says, I'm not even going to look at it.
Right.
All right. But for some reason, it was important to show that Schubert was influenced by this.
Well, he obviously referred it on for a substantive investigation, which we don't challenge here. There had to be some reason why he did it. I believe the evidence was he did it because the referral came not from Layton, but from Mike Pismuka, who is the official who had the animus against Mr. Rattigan, who was angry that he had been accused of discrimination, and the temporal proximity is very close in time between him being interviewed by EEO personnel and then.
Are you saying that what the evidence before the jury was that Schubert was testifying, he did it because it came from a high-ranking official in this very sensitive area, and he wasn't going to second-guess that judgment?
I don't believe he said Layton. I think, yes, that's in effect what the evidence was. And on some level, he had no choice. I mean, he gets a referral from a section chief of the Office of Internet Operations of the FBI. He would be remiss not to pass it on for some kind of investigation. They're saying the guy's a security risk. And by the way, there's no truth to any of those allegations. And the evidence of the trial was that there was no truth to any of those allegations. So don't, I know, you, Judge Taylor, you've said that Layton made some allegations that were true. There was no truth to these allegations. And Pismuka knew it. Pismuka knew.
It was true that he received clothing.
Yes, but they knew about that. He filed that.
It was true.
But that doesn't, but they're acting. And the way they put it together.
He did go to Mecca with them.
Sure,
he went there looking for a wife for him.
No, they weren't looking for a wife for him. But the evidence.
All those are
but
true.
But what is at issue is not the individual particulars of that. Well, the issue is whether he was a security risk.
I agree.
And whether he was doing his job. Because also part of this was they were saying he wasn't doing his job. He wasn't doing this investigation appropriately. And they knew from their own independent analysis that he was, in fact, doing a good job on that 9/11 investigation.
So. On your point about people being remiss if they didn't follow up on information they receive, wouldn't your position here, if accepted, make government officials more hesitant to refer people for security investigations or to initiate security investigations?
Well, I think it may, but that may be a judgment that the law should acknowledge as a good one. It also would ensure that, since there's apparently no limit.
Egan talks about the court shouldn't be second-guessing what constitutes an acceptable margin of error in assessing the potential risk, and that seems to me exactly what the allegations in this case raise, which is, you know, are these facts enough to justify an investigation? Well, in 2002, people were probably, as you say, would be remiss if they didn't refer allegations onward for an investigation.
I have to
and
go
people
back.
People will be more hesitant, presumably, if your position's accepted.
There also is the countervailing principle that, you know, people should be free from discrimination in their workplace and retaliation.
I agree completely with that, and that's a good Justice White had a good dissent in Egan, and as a matter of statutory interpretation, maybe Congress should be making these judgments instead of the courts, but that's not the position that prevailed in
but
Egan.
But here, since the plaintiff did not challenge the substance of that decision, whether he was a security risk or not, did not made by the security division, did not challenge, was not challenging a denial or revocation, you don't have the kind of justiciability problem that you had in Egan and the other progeny. And so I know I've taken.
One last question, which is the Fourth Circuit decision in Becerra.
I think Becerra is not a whole lot different than Egan. I think Becerra, there you're dealing with once again, a revocation or denial of a security clearance.
But it talked about the impossibility of drawing the line between initiation
right.
And
it's a difficult job. I mean, certainly the line should not be if I hear the government right, they're saying there's no need to draw the line because any federal official can basically retaliate against somebody by saying this is a security risk and they get away scot-free. There's immunity there. And so it's a difficult test, but we have to draw a line. I think Judge Hovell in this case, and she did it with very little time on the eve of trial, did an unassailable job in terms of how she drew the line. And she looked at Egan, she looked at Becerra, she looked at the cases, and she set it out. And by the way, she set out the fact that this was in addition to, we're not challenging the substance, there's no denial and revocation. She said, based on the government's own documents that they submitted in an earlier proceeding before her, that OIO officials were not the proper officials to conduct to make these kind of security determinations, that it was the security division. That was an exhibit that she referred to in her decision, and an earlier decision at Radigan 3 at 604 Fed Sup 44. So I understand it's difficult, but I think that's, I mean, that's why they pay you the big money, I guess, to make that determination. But I don't think it's close here.
You must be talking about a different court.
That cuts maybe against you. Let me...
sorry, Judge.
Let me ask you, when you responded to Judge Tatel, I just want to be clear. Your position that all of the charges were false is based on the point that OIO officials knew all of this. Let me just finish my sentence so you're clear what I'm concerned about. OIO knew he got the clothes, knew he had the Hajj, knew he how he operated his operation, knew he was a bachelor, knew he dated nurses, knew he had parties, they knew all of these things, and yet there was no discipline of him by OIO on the grounds that he was either a sloppy manager or he wasn't doing quality work, so that in that, when you say false, you don't mean that he didn't get the Saudi Arabian clothes, but it's simply that OIO knew that and had known it and never had thought anything about it.
Until he started complaining.
Once he made the charge of discrimination, then all of a sudden these events that he had fully disclosed and they had no problem with, those events became the basis for a referral.
I think there's two things. One is the real issue that they knew was not present was whether he was a security risk. They knew he wasn't a security risk. They rely on Layton's 18-page EC to list several things. We could go through each one of those and tell you why it wasn't. It's not a question of misconduct or something that required discipline. He was not consorting with prostitutes, nurses.
So you want to draw the line at if the plaintiff's claim involves no challenge to the substantive decision made as to whether he is or is not entitled to a security clearance, then Egan does not bar the issue from being addressed by a court. Yours is even narrower. It's where it's that plus the security determination is that his security clearance should be continued.
Well, the cases only speak about attacking the substance of the determination to deny or revoke. I understand this case hasn't been before a court on these set of facts, but certainly Egan and his progeny set out what we think is a clear line of demarcation. More importantly, I think the real danger in this case is if you accept the government's judgment that any federal official is charged with the predictive judgment of making these kind of determinations. Sure, they can make a referral, but if they do, and it's because they want to strike back and retaliate, they should be held accountable for it. And then the facts of this case, I mean, it's not as if somebody makes makes this kind of referral, a bad faith referral to retaliate, in a vacuum. There's a background there of complaints, a history of a relationship between the employer and the employee that the court can look at to determine whether this case crosses the line from justiciability to non-justiciability.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government?
It's clear that the court understands the degree to which the retaliation claim called in to question the predictive judgment of the security division officials here, so I'm not going to belabor that point unless the court wants me to respond to any particular points. But I do want to emphasize one thing that counsel repeatedly stood up here and said, is that OIO officials knew he wasn't a security risk. That is a formulation that suggests that, as we have been arguing all along, even the OIO officials are in some respects called upon to exercise predictive judgment. It can only be wrong to have made the referral based on these largely uncontested facts, if they were supposed to do some sort of filtering, some sort of judging, is this sufficient security risk? Is it not sufficiently serious security risk? That's, in some respects, what executive order and particularly section 6.2B calls upon employees who have access to classified information to do, to make a judgment. You know, in context, is the wearing of Saudi Arabian attire at official functions, is that suggestive of some sort of foreign influence? You have to make those sorts of determinations. And we're talking about an agency in which everyone, as I think one of the judges pointed out in the colloquy earlier, everyone is sensitized to security risk. We're not talking about the Park Service.
What about my hypothetical? I'll put it that way so you won't be fearful of answering it.
I probably will be.
OIO knew, let's just say there were five facts that were in the EC, that they knew those five facts. They'd known them for a while. He had disclosed everything to them.
Right.
And they'd never made any referral. And then the temporal proximity of his complaints and their referral is enough to raise an inference that it wasn't being done for security reasons, and there's no judgment involved as to the security division's analysis, and there's no suggestion by the executive order that these OIO officials were being, how should I say it, negligent in carrying out their own duties under the executive order when they didn't refer him earlier to the security division for investigation? I mean, is there no line to be drawn?
I think what matters here is that there's sort of an accumulation of facts that eventually suggests maybe we should pass this along to the people who make the determination
nothing
about revising.
When they learned those five facts, they had those facts before them. They made no referral. That's what the record shows. All right, they knew everything, the wife, the clothes, the Hajj, the way you find out, how you get in contact with him while he's away.
They found out a lot of that from Layton, who went over there and observed those things personally. I think that's a fair characterization of the record, Your Honor. They found out those
things.
Actually,
a lot of Layton's statement is somebody told me.
Well, some of it is, but again,
he has no personal knowledge at all. He's relying on what somebody told him. In any event, that's why I put it in terms of a hypothetical for you. They have these five facts. They know them. OIO does. OIO does nothing with them. They're perfectly happy with this man and how he's performing. All right? My hypothetical is months pass, something happens, he files an EEO complaint. He starts complaining to them about discrimination. Then they refer. Now, no line to be drawn?
I understand, Your Honor, but Egan recognizes that, for instance, a security clearance could be revoked or denied for discriminatory reasons and says that you can't review that. So you're essentially in the same box.
My hypothetical is there's no reviewing going on here. I'm getting at is that OIO made a judgment at one point in time that this set of facts did not warrant a referral. Then he starts complaining against them in terms of discrimination. Then they make the referral.
I understand.
Now, the only thing that changed is he's filed these complaints against him. No line to be drawn?
Well, I don't know what the line is that you're suggesting should be drawn.
OIO has these five data points, and they know that on January 1.
Right.
All right? They know all this. Nothing changes until June when he files an EEO complaint. That's when they refer this over to the security division.
I understand, Your Honor. And that looks like retaliation is your point.
Well, I'm asking you, is there no line to be drawn? That was just hypothetical to you earlier on where I asked you, so I was very clear what your position was. And as I understand it, there is no line to be drawn.
My response is the same. It is that if that decision was made, responding to your hypothetical, your exact hypothetical, I think plaintiff's view is that if it was a security division person, someone who has security in their title, who then made the decision to open up an investigation, that we'd be within Egan. And we agree, you would be within Egan there, and it seems from the court's questions that the court might agree with that as well, that if it's a security division person, one charged with the ultimate clearance or revocation, our point is simply, it doesn't matter that they have security in their title, because all of the agency employees at the FBI are required to report these things. And that, so the risk of the unjustified retaliation, yes, it exists. It does. Egan recognizes that risk and makes a balance that the national security concerns are more important. The risk exists in both cases.
The concern is the balance in Egan is between a relatively small group of people who have the authority to revoke and a larger but still small group of people who have the authority to initiate. This would be, in those circumstances, the idea is that trumps your right to sue for discrimination or retaliation. But when you expand it to a huge universe of people who can refer and still say it trumps, maybe the balance becomes different, or at least the concerns become greater, because what your position is that race-based or gender-based referrals for security investigations, too bad.
Well, and
despite Title VII and the anti-discrimination laws, and that's a tough sell.
Well, I think it's a sell that's been accepted already in Becerra and Hill and Pinnock, in the sense that they have recognized that there's no difference between the initiation of the investigation and the ultimate revocation. The only distinction in this case, and the distinction that the district court relied upon,
you agree there's a huge, the number of people who have authority to revoke and the number of people who have authority to initiate a security investigation, much, much smaller.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I agree with that.
But a small percentage of the people who could refer someone, because this applies to, doesn't the order apply, all employees?
But again, it's in the unique context of the FBI. Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. I agree that the universe is larger. My point is simply that courts have already started going down this line, Becerra, Hill, Pinnock.
Do we follow?
Yeah.
Well, that is the question.
Becerra, of course. Different facts, but at any rate.
Well,
all right, I think we have your argument, unless my colleagues have further questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.